What you're about to hear was aired on Planet Philadelphia, environmental radio show on Germantown Community Radio, 92.9 FM, WGGTLP in Philadelphia, and on gtownradio.com.
We have an interesting topic we're going to be talking about today, and it's a proposal to rewild the American West. Our guests today are George Werthner and Dr. Boone Kaufman. And we usually start out asking people to talk about themselves. So, Boone, could you tell folks a little bit about yourself?
Sure. My research and education and teaching basically entails looking at the influences of land use, cattle grazing, forestry, shrimp ponds and wetlands with the natural ecosystems, the value and the ecosystem services provided by natural ecosystems with climate change. So that interaction, how humans exacerbate climate change and what are approaches that we could take to mitigating climate change, restoring biological diversity through enhanced conservation activities, enhanced land management.
George, if you could tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm primarily a writer who writes about public lands issues in general. And I try to interpret scientific information, I guess is the best way to say it, and make it available to people that maybe don't have the science background or the grasp of the subject that is sometimes required to understand it in detail. And I've been doing that for a long time, and I travel a lot around on public lands and try to see them firsthand, which I hope gives me a little more authority when I do write something, because I can say, you know, I've actually been to this spot and seen this particular issue. So that's what I do.
Why don't the two of you tell us how you got involved with the proposal to rewild public lands in the West?
One of the things is that we know that we're living in a climate crisis, and this threatens not only the biological diversity, but the very survival of humanity. In order for us to be proactive and to address climate crisis, the biodiversity crisis, all facets of society and government needs to become involved. And this also includes the livestock or the agriculture sector, as well as the natural resources sector. And this is very much in the administrative purview of United States Department of Agriculture, United States Department of Interior, that manages our public lands, to do their fair share of addressing the climate crisis. And I think that our proposal then, you know, of approximately 20 authors with centuries of experience in understanding the values of public lands, the threats to public land through land management, and the potential role that they could play in climate change mitigation and adaptation is such that we were able to, this is our attempt at suggesting an initial approach to restoring and preserving the biological diversity, addressing the climate change crisis for future generations. You know, it's the role that agriculture and natural resources can play.
George, did you want to say something here?
I'll emphasize what he just said, which is that, you know, we've learned in the last 10 or 15 years, both the massive contribution that livestock emissions make to climate warming, and even more recently that logging and manufacturing wood products makes in releasing carbon into the atmosphere. You know, both of these things occur on public lands, and there's a good argument to be made that from a national policy perspective, setting aside public forest lands as carbon reserves and reducing the impacts of livestock grazing, which is more than just the emissions, but how they affect the land, like riparian areas, which can soak up and maintain a lot of carbon. This whole idea of reserves goes hand in hand with trying to initiate some sort of start in reducing climate warming. This is not the only thing that can be done, but this is a relatively simple thing that could be done relative to other things that would perhaps make a significant contribution toward keeping carbon out of the atmosphere.
I think this is a good time to tell people what it is that is actually being proposed.
Well, you know, our proposal, basically, we looked at the public lands of the American West and found those areas through analysis of both the lands, the values of the lands, the connectivity of the lands, what would be some of the most feasible ways to connect and to preserve the various landscapes and biological diversity of the American West, and looking at connectivity of large areas. Here we're talking about the area, say, from the Canadian border of the Cascades through the Cascades of Washington and Oregon and into the Sierra Nevada of California, the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, and then even extending down into Colorado, the Mogollon Rim of Arizona, and down into New Mexico. These are some of the largest areas of public lands that we do have the ability to restore them and to provide the connectivity and ecological benefits that large areas would exist. And to do this, we need to have some of the keystone species restored, the gray wolf, the Mexican wolf, beavers in the riparian zones, and stop those activities that are causing degradation. And the most widespread activity on these lands is livestock grazing that is causing the desertification, exacerbating climate change, and threatening biological diversity.
I would add in that the principle that we're using is a thing called island biogeography in conservation biology principles, which is large areas are much more likely to maintain most species because there's a lot of habitat and there's a lot of connectivity between habitat. Whereas if you have small protected areas, you're going to lose species. So part of the justification for large areas, of course, is besides the carbon that we talked about earlier, is that this will provide habitat for a lot of species that would otherwise maybe go extinct. And so by using the umbrella, for example, of the wolf, which has a wide-ranging needs to, you know, to have a sufficiently large population, we indirectly cover a lot of territory that's also essential habitat to all sorts of other plants and animals.
And is that the same with beavers?
Predominantly, beavers are very, very important because we've lost probably 90 to 95% of the beaver numbers in the American West. They are incredibly important engineers in influencing the stream, the headwater streams, but their impacts are not only what one would see where they're building dams and creating altered habitats, but through recharging groundwater, changing the water flows, affecting water quality. All of that has vast impacts downstream for all the downstream users, therefore ameliorating impacts of climate change, as well as allowing and probably providing this valuable ecosystem service, clean water, abundant water for users downstream.
So right now we're having not only the mega fires in the West, but a lot of droughts. So are you saying that those two species will help with those issues?
George, you want to take that?
Well,
restoring beaver and an improvement in riparian areas and the creation of many more ponds. One of the things you get with a restoration of a riparian area is they expand outward so that they're wider. And these green wet areas, of course, resist fire spread and can act as natural fire breaks on the landscape that are very effective in dry times. And the other way that the restoration of beaver can also affect fire, for example, aspen are more resistant to fire than conifer trees, most deciduous plants are. And it sounds weird, but when the beaver cut down the aspen, they stimulate more aspen growth. So you actually may get an expansion of those green aspen areas in areas where you have significant number of beaver.
Yeah, I just might add to that, not only, you know, the impacts of the beavers, but we know through our research in Yellowstone and many other areas of the West that the reintroduction of the wolves create this trophic cascades where we see at these valuable communities such as the Quaking Aspen, the riparian zones begin to recover. We see increases in the wetland species, the willows, the alders, the cottonwoods. All of these are incredibly important for biological diversity, but they also create moisture, cooler conditions, and function as fire breaks, as well as, you know, creating cooler stream temperatures, affecting the flows of the streams. So this is the restoration, the recovery of the wolves and the beavers, while at the same time, we need to stop those activities that are causing degradation or preventing recovery. And that's the livestock. You know, livestock are on over 85% of all public lands in the West. And these greatly contribute to climate change. They exacerbate the impacts of climate change by desertification, creating warmer and drier conditions. And then finally, they shift the ecosystems from carbon sinks to sources of greenhouse gases. Again, the removal of livestock then would probably be the most effective means of addressing the climate crisis on our public lands in the West.
Maybe you can say more about the increasing of carbon dioxide by cows. I don't think people necessarily know about the methane aspect of that.
Yeah. Livestock themselves, through enteric fermentation, their fermentation process, they result in greenhouse gas emissions that on the public lands of about 12.4 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalents largely through methane production per year. This is a social carbon cost based on current federal standards of well over $500 million a year to the American people or to the world, and having significant additional impacts on affecting human health, human lives, exacerbating climate change, reducing crop yields, et cetera, et cetera. We see shifts through the overgrazing on the public lands. We see the loss of carbon stocks. You know, we see the shifts from sagebrush or aspen or these beautiful streamside forested communities to grasslands dominated by exotic species. All of these greatly exacerbate and increase climate change.
You mentioned cattle and the effects they have. I imagine, though, that the people who are running the cattle will be kind of upset about the idea of not having them on public lands.
We address that in that we endorse the idea of a voluntary, or maybe not voluntary, but anyway, a permit buyout, where grazing on public lands is a privilege. It's not something that, you know, you are automatically guaranteed that you can continue to do. What we propose is that based on the amount of forage that is annually consumed by a rancher's livestock, they would get some sort of compensation based on that. And with that money, they would be free to either acquire other private lands for grazing, or in many cases, given that a lot of ranchers are getting to retirement age, it might be a way for them to retire gracefully, and so forth. So part of the package, if enacted the way we've envisioned it, would have some sort of compensation program.
You know, while the impacts of livestock grazing on our public lands is significant, equivalent to about the greenhouse gases alone are about 2.3 million passenger vehicles. That's the equivalent. Yet it is only about 1.5% of the nation's beef supply. Our proposal suggests maybe removing 26% of them. It wouldn't even be witnessed at the supermarket. We're talking about 0.5% at best of the nation's beef supply. We're talking about an equitable and fair buyout of this small minority. of livestock operators in the West, and certainly a tiny, tiny minority in the United States. And it's cost the federal government over $120 million per year to administer the grazing program. That's in excess of the amount they take in. They only charge the livestock operators $1.35 per animal unit month. That's the charge they have for one cow and one calf on the public lands for a month. But the cost to the government can be anywhere from $6 to $12 per AUM. So you can see that the savings alone would be more than enough to buy out these ranchers. And finally, the way the climates are shifting, these lands are really no longer suitable for grazing. It's really very difficult to even make a living off the lands without severely damaging the biological diversity. What we think, though, is that through this rewilding program, the water quality, the enhanced water that's going to come off these lands is going to be very meaningful for agricultural interests downstream, municipal interests downstream, that will be far exceed the value that we would have had we continued to graze these lands under a changing climate.
I would add on to what Boone just said, that when he's talking about the cost to the public, that's just the financial cost of the administration and doesn't really go into cost accounting of all the ecological damage. For example, as he mentioned, the reduction in water flow that we currently experience, that water has value to society. And the loss of that water or reduction in water because of the impacts of grazing is not part of that grazing fee or any of those computations. And, you know, there are other things, too. The money we spend trying to recover endangered species, ranchers don't pay for that, even if their livestock are responsible for those things. Or the spread of cheatgrass, which is a very flammable annual on rangelands in the West, and we're having to spend more and more firefighting because of the spread of cheatgrass. So my point being is that if you add in all those other costs, the real true actual cost of livestock grazing on public lands is far, you know, exceeds anything that it would cost us to retire those grazing allotments.
Speaking of costs, what is the cost of implementing your program initially and then in an ongoing way?
You know, it would be reasonably minor because the infrastructure, the public lands administration is already there. Probably the greatest barriers to instituting this rewilding program are not the financial barriers or even the ecological barriers. You know, we know how to restore these lands through enhanced beaver management, wolf management, livestock removal. The hardest thing, of course, would be the social barriers, overcoming the reluctance to remove the livestock off the public lands, to stop the killing of wolves, to stop the trapping of beavers on these lands, given their ecological values. So I don't see it as being a very expensive endeavor other than, say, cost of retiring livestock permits, while at the same time, you know, the income and the savings to the American taxpayers would be so great that would far exceed the cost of retiring the lands. And these are all public lands, I might add, too. It's not like we're advocating private lands or any sort of buyout or changing private land structure. So it would be quite minimal in its impacts on social systems and cost to governments in these areas. Yet the benefits would be great.
You mentioned social pressure. I don't know, George, do you want to talk about that?
Well, you know, the social problem is that in rural communities, there is generally a negative attitude towards the federal government. And there's an irony there in that without the federal government input of funds in a lot of these rural communities, they would be in financial disaster. I remember looking at the situation when the Malheur Wildlife Refuge was taken over by the Bundy folks, and I looked at what contribution all levels of government made to the county employment. And it was something like 56% of all income in the county came from government. You could imagine what would happen if, you know, the BLM or the Forest Service or State Fish and Game or whoever is the government people working there were to be eliminated from these rural counties. But the real truth is that enhancing the biological capabilities of these lands might actually improve their economic situation, given, I'll just make up one thing, fishing is a big deal around the West in terms of certain communities get a lot of benefit from trout fishing. The restoration of beaver and the improvement in water quality and water flow would no doubt increase the fisheries in the region. So you may actually have a net gain to your economy, but trying to convince people that that's going to happen is often a difficult situation. Although in retrospect, they often come to embrace these changes after they've occurred.
It sounds like you need to get the fly fishermen on your side.
Well, that's one option. Bird watching is a big thing in the West. And riparian areas are very important for all sorts of bird species. 70-80% of all wildlife species in the West rely on these riparian areas. So if you improve the riparian areas, you would also improve the habitat for, say, songbirds and other species that are dependent on it. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of ways you could see the economy changing in a way that would be an improvement to the local economy, but it takes time and it's something that a lot of people just don't know whether it will happen or not. And so they're reluctant to embrace it.
Yeah, I might just add to that a little bit, make sure that we understand that we're in a climate crisis right now. Maintaining the status quo is not an option if we even want to have trout in the future. The fishermen are not going to have any fish if we don't do something now to address the climate crisis. And this is what our proposal is would increase and restore the resilience of these ecosystems in the face of climate change. Again, unless we do something similar at a large scale and be very proactive with the rewilding plan, we won't have birds. We won't have fish in these streams for any future generations to enjoy, as well as the other ecosystem services, again, coming back to water for downstream users in the future. Yes, there are a small number of livestock operators that will shift their operations, like the vast majority of livestock operators, to private lands, but at the same time, allowing the resources that allow them to grow their hay, to grow their crops, the water that's coming off the public lands is far more valuable and far more important for agriculture than the tiny amount of forage that comes off these lands.
Sometimes people have talked about replacing the cows with bison. What do you think about that idea?
Well, I'll jump in on that. If bison are cooped up and fenced and managed just like livestock, there are some differences in the way they use the land, but you would wind up perhaps getting many of the same impacts that you would have with domestic livestock in terms of like impacts to riparian areas and that sort of thing. Unless the bison are allowed to, you know, roam freely, I think you wind up having many of the same issues.
You know, in the Great Plains, that's, you know, North Dakota, South Dakota, you know, eastern Montana, that might be a significant improvement on land management. But in so much of the arid American West, the Great Basin, bison weren't, or even large herbivores, weren't a significant ecological impact. And that's one of the reasons why we've seen such terrible degradation and desertification, is because these are lands, these are plants that did not evolve with large animals and don't respond well to grazing. And so bison would not be any more suitable on these lands, the sagebrush dominated lands principally, than the livestock would be.
We touched on this a little bit, but beavers and wolves are not greeted well in many places. And why are people so against those two species?
I don't think that the beavers are so bad, other than on private lands where they can cause difficulties. We're talking about public lands where those conflicts between agriculture and beavers might be an issue. So that's not a big deal. The wolves, you know, I think goes all the way back to the mythology and the fairy tales that we had earlier about the big bad wolf or the wolves. But once I think people recognize their remarkable role as a keystone species, a species that has impacts throughout the landscape, they begin to accept that importance of having that animal on the landscape. Many areas, such as Europe, have very good wolf management and livestock wolf depredation programs. So I think that it's an education of the incredible importance of these species towards maintaining the biological diversity of our public lands. That message needs to get across.
I'll add on to it that the impact of predation by wolves on the livestock industry is actually very insignificant. Last year in Montana, for example, there were 250 livestock animals that were attributed their, you know, mortality to wolf predation, and tens of thousands die from poison plants or from freezing in the wintertime, birthing calves. Even dogs kill way more livestock every year than wolves in a lot of Western states. And so it's this sort of exaggerated threat that is based more on, I think, the idea that, well, you can't really protect your cattle from, for example, eating poison plants very readily or freezing to death in a winter storm, but you think you can do something about wolves, i.e. kill them. And so there's this sort of exaggerated risk from having wolves around that just doesn't pan out when you look at the actual numbers of livestock killed annually by wolf predation. And so there's always been this thing about killing predators. And ironically, there's even research that suggests that you may even increase the predation by the effects on the social ecology of predators, whether we're talking coyotes or cougar or wolves or whatever, in that when you break up, say, a wolf pack, and you've eliminated maybe the dominant hunters, that pack then is less efficient at hunting for natural prey and therefore may prey upon livestock more likely. And so we have even the idea of doing predator control may in fact increase predation likelihood.
I'm guessing that people might want to get more information. You can tell us how they might do that. I know there's this thing called Western Rewilding Network.
Yeah, I would suppose the best thing would be, yeah, for people to look up the Western Rewilding Network, the Sagebrush Sea Project, which is very similar to what we've suggested, except for extending out into the sagebrush lands. Our paper in Bioscience and several other of our articles that have looked at the importance of rewilding and restoring these lands for the American public and future generations.
Is there any way that people can help?
You know, one of the great values that Americans have is our public lands. You know, there's fewer, more precious, most spectacular landscapes on this planet. And it is incumbent on all of us to do our best to preserve these so our future generations can have the same opportunities that we've had to enjoy these public lands. Educating one on how important maintaining and managing keystone species like wolves, cougars, beavers, how our public lands are managed or even mismanaged in so many respects that are causing a threat to these incredible resources is very, very important. It's time for us to rethink how we manage public lands in the face of climate change, because what we're doing now is not sustainable and will result in pretty significant dire consequences if we don't do projects like this rewilding and implement them now and not even delay.
Would it be helpful for people to, say, contact the Department of the Interior or their local state legislators about the issues?
Absolutely.
I would say yes. That, you know, I've had lots of discussions with congressmen and so forth. And, you know, one guy in California one time told me he got one letter on some issue. He didn't know anything about it. But because one of his constituents had written him, he voted yes for that particular legislation. And if they get 100 letters on something, they think it's a real big deal then. And so I would say that that is one of the ways that anybody listening to this could really help out. Just write a simple letter, say, you know, maybe reference through Google or something like that, a particular article, and say that you support this rewilding concept for the public lands. And you might be surprised how much that might help, particularly among congressional delegations that aren't in the West, who might not be hearing this kind of thing all the time from their constituency.
All right. Well, one of the nice things about this whole idea is it's relatively simple. And as you say,
right,
not expensive to do. And so many of our solutions involve huge changes in administration, society organizations, and everything else. And this one really doesn't.
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah, this one is basically just letting nature take over and maintain itself. You know, we're suggesting very simple approaches, common sense approaches to land management, halting those activities that are causing degradation and restoring some of the principal keystone species that have these trophic cascades that will restore biological diversity and mitigate the impacts and adapt to the impacts of climate change. I think it's very important. And I just want to kind of, you know, we live in the West, George and I, and by the same token, we have great value for Independence Hall in Philadelphia and the Liberty Bell. We don't want that melted down and sold. We want that maintained. And I think the people in the East probably have the same, you know, ownership and value of the iconic lands of the American West to have them maintained and perpetuated for future generations. So them being active in advocating for their public lands in the West could be of tremendous value, I think, for all Americans.
Well, thank you so much, both of you, for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you for interviewing.
If you want to know more about Planet Philadelphia, go to planetphiladelphia.com. You could also find out more about other G-Town Radio programming by going to gtownradio.com. I hope you will consider making a small monthly donation to help Planet Philadelphia continue presenting interviews on important underreported environmental topics and exploring their complexities and intersections. Thank you so much for your support.